the train to Perpignan near the Spanish border. The French citizens aboard went about their normal routine, not a care in the world among them, except for one passenger, who just received some terrible news. The cigarette dangled in Nancy's mouth while her eyes were wide in disbelief. Her contact, sitting right behind her, assured her that everything was going to be all right. All she needed to do was meet at the rendezvous point, right on cue. The train began to slow. She took a couple of deep breaths and waited for the signal to move. She watched as her contact made his way to a window and quietly opened it. It seemed like forever, but Nancy finally got her cue. Now, she bolted from her seat, ran to the window, and jumped through it, hitting the ground hard. With no time to waste, she picked herself up and ran. Bullets whizzed by her. Faster and faster she ran, until finally, she was out of the line of fire. If only those German soldiers knew how close they were to catching Nancy Wake, the White Mouse. The French resistance fighter near the top of the Gestapo's most wanted list. This is Espionage, a new podcast original exploring the missions behind the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. I'm your host, Carter Roy. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. This is our first episode on Nancy Wake, a World War II French resistance member and British spy who was so successful in hiding refugees across France and sabotaging German garrisons that the Gestapo put a 5 million franc bounty on her head. Well, this week, we'll dive into Nancy's early life and explore how the former New Zealand journalist joined the French resistance during its infancy, was forced to escape when the Gestapo closed in on her, and then joined the British SOE. Next week, we'll follow her as she parachuted back into occupied France to coordinate with resistance groups and help the Allies defeat the Nazis. You can listen to all of Parcast shows on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes come out on Fridays. We are also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. Nancy Wake was born on August 30th, 1912, in Wellington, New Zealand. Her childhood wasn't the most idyllic. Her journalist father, Charles, moved the family to Sydney when Nancy was two, and then subsequently abandoned them 2 years later to attempt filmmaking in Hollywood. Nancy's relationship with her very religious mother was so strained that when she was 16, she ran away from home to become a nurse, using the alias Shirley Ann Kennedy. In March 1932, when Nancy was 20, she received a letter that would change her life forever. Her aunt, who was also considered a black sheep in the family, wrote to Nancy that she had been thinking of her lately and wanted to give her £200, over $17,000 today, to put towards her future. She could spend the money however she wished. It was the opportunity of a lifetime, and Nancy wasn't going to waste it. When she arrived in London, she followed in her father's footsteps and enrolled in journalism school at Queen's College. For Nancy, journalism represented the chance to continue traveling around the world and live a glamorous lifestyle. A year later, she began working for a newspaper and was relocated to Paris. Nancy fit right in with Paris life. She quickly made friends with the locals and enjoyed the nightlife. Life, however, wasn't always a party. Her main assignment was to cover a politician who was making waves across Europe, Adolf Hitler. In January of 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany under President Paul von Hindenburg. By August of 1934, Hitler had consolidated his power and was in total control of his country. Nancy chronicled everything, from the infamous Reichstag fire to the ban on labor unions to Germany's withdrawal from the League of Nations. She also reported on the increasingly anti-Semitic policies that were being enforced. In 1935, when Jews were stripped of their citizenship with the passing of the Nuremberg race laws, Nancy saw a wave of refugees flee to France and England. But everything Nancy had reported on up to this point, she'd written about from France. When a friend told her that Nazism had infiltrated the streets of Vienna, she had to see it for herself. Arriving in Vienna with a few of her other journalist friends, she was stunned to see German paramilitary forces everywhere. At a distance, she watched as they intimidated anyone who spoke out against Hitler or Nazism. Even worse, she couldn't believe her eyes when she saw how they treated Vienna's Jewish population. One event in particular would leave an everlasting effect on Nancy. While walking to the main square, Nancy witnessed a group of brown shirts, the common name for Nazi agents, tie a group of Jewish citizens to a large wheel, roll them around in circles, and then flog them with whips. In Nancy's own words, "Right there and then, I made up my mind that if I ever got the chance, I would do everything in my power to hurt them, to damage Nazis and everything they stood for." But at the time, all she could do was report on what she saw. Her resistance began via the pages of the press. She wrote article after article, warning the French citizens of the dangers of Nazism. Reporting on the rise of fascism in Germany proved to be emotionally exhausting. As a young 23-year-old living in Paris, it was easy to get caught up in the city's nightlife as a way to escape the horrors she wrote about. Soon, she and her friends would expand their hard drinking and late nights to weekend trips to the French Riviera. It was while on one of these vacations, in the summer of 1936, that she met Henri Fioca. Well, not much is known about Henri's past, except that he came from a wealthy family of steel industrialists in Marseille and had a reputation as a philanderer. He was charming and gracious, and Nancy found him fascinating. They would run into each other at parties and clubs, and each time he had a different woman on his arm. Nancy asked him point blank one night how he was able to be with so many beautiful women. "They ring me up," he replied, "but the one I want has never called." Well, Nancy knew he meant her. She responded that he would have to be the one who did the calling, and call he did. The relationship blossomed quickly. For the next 3 years, they would alternate between seeing each other in Paris and Marseille. In the spring of 1939, Henri proposed, and Nancy said yes. A few months later, the 26-year-old Nancy quit her job as a journalist and moved to Marseille. Then, suddenly, world events started moving very quickly. On September 1st, 1939, Hitler invaded Poland. 2 days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. Nancy and Henri decided to get married on November 30th. They were worried that Henri would be called away to fight any day, and their fear proved accurate. Just before Christmas, Henri received notice that it was time to serve. But Nancy couldn't just sit by and do nothing while her husband fought. She had a vow to keep. She demanded Henri buy her a truck that she could convert into an ambulance. This way, she could put her nursing background to use and ferry wounded soldiers to safety. Henri wasn't too pleased that his new wife wanted to put herself in danger, but he also knew she wouldn't take no for an answer. Henri was ordered to deploy in March 1940. In May, the German army rolled their tanks across the French-Belgian border. War had finally come to France. Nancy in her new ambulance, was stunned at what she saw when she arrived on the battlefield. The dead were everywhere. Trucks and tanks were blown out. The German bombing was relentless. They had put France in complete turmoil in only a matter of days. Nancy ferried soldiers across the lines to safety, but it wasn't just wounded soldiers she transported. The fighting led to civilian refugees caught in the crossfire who needed safe passage. She began shuttling them to safety as well. She constantly thought of Henri out fighting somewhere as she cared for the wounded and the dying. On June 14, 1940, Paris fell. Nancy, devastated and worried about the lack of news from Henri, retreated to Marseille and waited. Along the way, her ambulance truck broke down, and she was forced to hike and hitch the rest of the way home. A week later, newly appointed Prime Minister Henri-Philippe Pétain signed an armistice agreement with Germany. Northern France became German-occupied territory, and southern France was allowed to govern itself in the new capital of Vichy. Pétain was given full power to rule in this new southern French state. The cost of peace was to stay neutral in the war between Germany and England. To Nancy, the fall of France and the sudden rise of this new government was appalling. She couldn't fathom how the people around her could capitulate to the Nazis so easily. A few weeks after the armistice agreement, Henri returned, alive and well. Nancy was overjoyed to see him. They watched anxiously to see what Pétain and his new French government would do next. In October 1940, Pétain met with Hitler and declared that France was on a path of collaboration with Germany. Nancy was outraged. As someone who spent more than half a decade witnessing firsthand what the Nazis were capable of, she knew what this meant for France. She couldn't accept Pétain's decision. She had to keep fighting. But how exactly was she to fight? Oddly enough, it was Nancy and Henri's socialite connections that provided them with their entryway into the French resistance. As the two continued to mingle around Marseille, their circle of friends expanded to include many who resented the Vichy government. A friend of theirs, known only as Commander Busch, was one such man. According to Nancy, her first involvement with the resistance occurred at the beginning of 1941, when she ran into Commander Busch on the streets of Marseille. She mentioned to Busch that she and Henri were going to be taking a trip to Cannes. Busch, knowing Nancy's political views, asked if she could deliver a package for him. Without hesitation, and without asking what the package was, Nancy said yes. While on the way to Cannes, she stopped in Toulouse, as directed. There, she met an unnamed man who was waiting for her. She quickly and discreetly handed off the package and was back on the road in no time. When she returned to Marseille, Busch asked her to deliver another package to the same man in Toulon. Nancy agreed, again without question. Soon, the man from Toulon asked her to take a package for him to Lyon. She said yes, and just like that, Nancy Wake became a courier for the French resistance. Coming up, things come to a head when a traitor exposes Nancy and puts her in Germany's crosshairs. Now, back to the story. At the beginning of 1941, 28-year-old Nancy Wake was suddenly swept into the French resistance. The resistance was still very much in its infancy at this time. It consisted of a loose network of small cells throughout France devoted to sabotaging the Vichy government. It was right up Nancy's alley. Well, Nancy's role was simple: deliver messages back and forth between various groups. Well, the idea was to connect the scattered cells and form one larger network. Nancy would secretly travel all around southern France, to Marseille, Nice, Toulouse, and Toulon. In the weeks and months that followed, Nancy began delivering more than just messages. Radio parts quickly became a major element of her courier work. She would hide these parts by sewing them into the lining of her coat. Thanks to Nancy's deliveries, communication between resistance cells became all that much easier. As Nancy immersed herself in the resistance, she maintained her upper-class facade with Henri, using it as her cover. When she wasn't delivering messages or radio parts, she was socializing with the denizens of Marseille, from affluent housewives to employees of Henri's factories. She threw lavish parties to give off the appearance that she was just another rich Marseille wife with no concern about what was going on in the rest of Europe. On one of her nights out, early in her resistance work, Nancy noticed a man sitting at the bar inside the Hôtel de l'Évêque. What made this man stand out was the fact that he was a blonde fellow reading a book in English. Something wasn't right. English, at this time, was rarely spoken in southern France. This man was clearly a foreign spy. Nancy had Henri go investigate. After a few minutes, he returned with intel. The man was, in fact, British. A British officer at that. Nancy was shocked. The officer was confined at Fort Saint-Jean. He and about 200 other British officers, in accordance with the armistice agreement, were essentially under house arrest. The men were allowed to go about their day, but when it was time for bed, they had to return to the fort. Well, Nancy was thrilled to be talking with a Brit. She offered to smuggle him and the other officers supplies to make their time at the fort easier, such as a radio or better food. She and Henri also invited the British officers over for dinner. Nancy was now working for both the French freedom fighters and British interned officers. As luck would have it, she would soon encounter another foreign ally. Around April 1941, one of Nancy's interned officer friends at Saint-Jean, a Scot named Ian Garrow, became aware of a potential recruit named Patrick O'Leary. O'Leary, whose real name was Albert Marie Gouris, was actually a Belgian doctor posing as both a French naval POW and a British officer. The confusion led to him being interned at Saint-Hippolyte-de-Fort. O'Leary's penchant for deception made Garrow think he had the makings of a spy. He cabled his superiors in London, and the War Office told Garrow to recruit him. Garrow organized a daring rescue mission, and after it succeeded, O'Leary joined Nancy's network of resistance members. As 1941 continued, Nancy, along with Garrow and O'Leary, created a network of tunnels and safe houses throughout southern France. It became known as the Garrow Line, similar to the famous American Underground Railroad, but with the objective of getting refugees away from the Nazis. Nancy's husband Henri helped finance these escape lines and allowed them to use his steel factories as safe houses. Their operations were growing, but it became apparent to Nancy that the number of refugees was about to increase dramatically. In October of 1940, the Vichy administration passed its first statute on Jews. They did it without any pressure from Berlin on Prime Minister Pétain's orders. The law stripped the citizenship of all French Jews and made foreign Jews illegal, meaning they weren't allowed to enter the country, and the ones currently residing in France were the first to be rounded up and sent to camps. Nancy watched as Jewish businesses were forced to close and Jewish citizens were moved into ghettos. Word soon spread that Jews in France were being rounded up and sent to concentration camps. It became obvious to Nancy and the others in the resistance that Jewish refugees needed to escape across the border. Using the same escape lines they'd created for Allied soldiers, Nancy and the others began smuggling Jews out of France. Nancy would send and receive heavily coded messages via radio or phone. When she knew it was safe, she would escort refugees to a safe house. If they took the train, Nancy and the group sat separately, though within view of one another. The final destination on the escape line was the town of Perpignan. Located about 20 miles north of the French-Spanish border, the town was full of resistance fighters. From there, trained guides would take the refugees across the daunting Pyrenees Mountains. For the rest of 1941, Nancy and her group of resistance fighters were able to successfully smuggle out hundreds of Allied soldiers and Jewish refugees without any trouble. However, that changed in December, just as the United States entered the war. Nancy arrived at her Marseille home to find Ian Garrow sitting with a man named Harold Cole. The moment she laid eyes on Cole, she knew he was trouble. As it turned out, Cole had been lying to everyone about his rank and history, claiming he was a holdover from the Dunkirk evacuation. In reality, he deserted before Dunkirk even occurred. But no one in the network was the wiser, and Cole was brought into the ranks of the resistance. Cole wasn't very good at working within the network, constantly failing to perform the tasks he was charged with. Things came to a head around Christmas time in 1941, when Cole was caught stealing money intended for an agent in the field. Cole confessed and was locked in the bathroom while Nancy, Garrow, O'Leary, and the others debated what to do with him. But before they could come to a decision, Cole escaped. Cole went straight to the Gestapo, the Nazi police, and made a deal, giving them the names of all the people he knew in the resistance network. Because Nancy had distrusted Cole from the beginning, she had refused to work with him and never gave him her name. This saved her from arrest. However, Garrow wasn't so lucky. Garrow spent the first few months of his capture in solitary confinement. Nancy managed to send him packages containing food and wrote him letters, establishing a cover story that she was Garrow's first cousin. Garrow was soon transferred to serve 10 years at Mozoc Prison. Thankfully, through a contact, Nancy learned that a guard at Mozoc could be easily bribed. It was clear to her that the only way they could save their friend was if they broke him out. November 1942. As the Allies descended upon French Morocco and Algeria, freeing it from the grasp of the Vichy government, Nancy Wake was almost 500 miles away on a train to Mozoc. Nancy had no idea who the corrupt guard was that she was supposed to bribe. She was taking a huge risk. Every Saturday, Nancy, in the guise of Garrow's first cousin, came to the camp with food for her emaciated friend, giving off an air of austerity and searching for her intended accomplice. For several weeks, Nancy visited Garrow without any luck finding the corrupt guard. Then, one Saturday, while leaving the camp, a guard passed Nancy on her bike and threw a note at her. Inside the note was a location and time. La Linda Bridge, midnight. Nancy arrived at the bridge and waited for over 2 hours in the cold, but the man never showed up. Though she was annoyed, she didn't lose her determination. She continued visiting Garrow, hoping her luck would improve. While sitting at a bistro one afternoon, a man approached Nancy and claimed to recognize her from her frequent trips to the camp. He sat down and whispered bluntly, 500,000 francs and a police uniform. At last, Nancy had made contact with the elusive corrupt guard. She didn't so much as flinch at the request. Instead, she asked how much the down payment would be. The guard demanded 100,000 francs. Nancy was able to get him to agree to 50,000, a little over $18,000 today. After the meeting, she rang her husband, Henri, for the money. Within an hour, Henri had wired her the 50,000 franc down payment, and the cash was in the hands of the guard. The next day, she went to visit Garrow again, but was confronted by the commandant about her large wire transfer. Nancy denied it, and continued to deny it when pressed, and the commandant eventually backed off. But from that moment on, Germany's eyes were upon her. At the end of November, O'Leary traveled with Nancy to Mozoc, pretending to be her husband. While Nancy spoke with Garrow at the camp, O'Leary was at the bistro with the guard, making plans for Garrow's escape. The following week, December 8, 1942, Nancy did not visit Garrow. Instead, she was in Marseille, playing the role of socialite wife. Meanwhile, 400 miles away in Mozoc, Ian Garrow quietly went into a restroom, found a camp police uniform, and put it on. From there, he casually attached himself to a group of marching guards and walked out of the main gate without any trouble. Down the road, a car awaited him. He was taken to Toulouse, using the same escape line that he helped establish. A month later, Garrow made the journey across the Pyrenees and sailed to Britain. He was free. Garrow's successful escape to England meant that he was no longer in the crosshairs of the occupying German forces, but for everyone still in France, things were about to get much worse. In response to Allied victories in northern Africa in November 1942, Germany invaded the remainder of France, disposing of Pétain and his puppet government. This meant that the Gestapo presence in Vichy increased as well, making life for the resistance even more dangerous. And with the surge of Gestapo members in France came the creation of a French variant, the Milice. In time, they became just as brutal as the Gestapo. At the beginning of 1943, with the Gestapo and the Milice patrolling France, the danger level for Nancy Wake increased tenfold. But that didn't stop her from helping Allied soldiers and Jewish refugees escape. It was around this time, not long after the Garrow escape, that word reached Nancy that the Gestapo were looking for a woman they dubbed the White Mouse. They were looking for her. She found the White Mouse moniker quite amusing. Less amusing was the threat to her and Henri should she be found out. And soon, Nancy began noticing strange and ominous signs that the Gestapo was closing in. She began to notice clicking sounds on the phone, as if it were being tapped. Sometimes, it would ring and there was only dead air on the other end. She'd find her mail opened, and even worse, the owner of a cafe she frequented, a personal friend of hers, told her that she was being followed. Nancy told Henri, and he immediately demanded that she flee to England. Nancy didn't want to leave her husband and beg for him to come, but Henri couldn't, not yet. He needed to stay behind and look after his factories, and he knew that both of them traveling together would only make it more dangerous. He promised that when the time was right, he would meet her in London. So, in January of 1943, Nancy Wake began making plans for her own escape, using the same route she had helped thousands of refugees through. Little did she know, her escape attempt would turn into the most daunting 6 months of her life. Coming up, we'll follow Nancy's harrowing escape out of France and her decision to continue the fight when she makes it to Britain. Now, back to the story. In January of 1943, French resistance fighter Nancy Wake discovered that the Gestapo were closing in on her. She reluctantly decided it was time to leave France. The decision wasn't easy. She was heartbroken that she had to leave her husband Henri. With a final kiss, she was off. It was the last time they ever saw each other. Getting out of France wasn't going to be easy, not even with Nancy's underground connections. In the first week of her escape, Nancy attempted to cross the mountains twice, using the same guides that many of her allied pilots or refugees used. Both times, she had to turn around because the weather was atrocious. She continued to watch the mountains from Perpignan, but a storm blew in and made everything worse. Frustrated, she decided to return to Toulouse. But then, just before arriving, her train was suddenly forced to stop. Police officers stormed the compartments and arrested everyone, including Nancy. While being ushered to jail, her truck came to a stop and Nancy bolted. Unfortunately for her, she ran into a group of protesting students and was easily captured by the police. She was interrogated at a nearby police station. During the war, anyone traveling across Nazi-occupied territory needed to have a stated purpose. The police demanded to know why a woman from Marseille was traveling from Perpignan to Toulouse. Nancy told her interrogators that she had been in Perpignan with her husband on business, but they had an ugly argument, so she left. The police didn't believe her. They wanted information about a recent bombing that took place in a Toulouse movie theater that was playing a pro-fascist film. The police knew it was a resistance bomb and needed someone to pin it on. For 4 days, Nancy was tortured into confessing that she was involved with the bombing. But then, on the fourth day, the doors to the interrogation room opened and in walked O'Leary with two police officers. Nancy was thrilled but concerned. What was he doing here? Was he arrested too? Word had reached the resistance that Nancy, after 3 days of torture, had not sold out a single person. O'Leary was there to break her out. The plan was for him to impersonate a milice and claim that Nancy was his mistress. The ruse miraculously worked. Upon her release, Nancy stayed undercover at the house of a spinster named Françoise de Sade. For weeks, she continued to make attempts to cross the Pyrenees. All of them ended in failure. Nancy was not accustomed to failure. How was it possible that she could send so many people across these mountains, and now, when she needed to do it herself, she couldn't succeed? In that time, Françoise managed to arrange a prison escape for 10 Allied soldiers. These 10 men joined Nancy at the safe house and were scheduled to leave together for Spain when the time was right. They would split into two groups, with Nancy and O'Leary as the respective leaders. The two groups traveled to Perpignan by train sometime around March 1943. On the ride up, O'Leary told Nancy that the train was soon going to be inspected by the Germans. Sure enough, the train slowed down. On O'Leary's orders, Nancy made a break for it and jumped through an open window. As Nancy ran through the forest, a hail of machine gun fire chased after her. In all the excitement, Nancy soon realized that she forgot her bag and identification card. But she had managed to get away, and after 3 hours of running through the forest, she made it to the designated rendezvous point. One of the men from O'Leary's group, a fellow New Zealander named Guy, was already there. Shortly after that, O'Leary, banged and bruised, joined them. But after 2 more hours of waiting, no one else arrived. Guy offered to look for them and disappeared into the night. Nancy would later learn that Guy was captured and sent to a concentration camp, dying while in captivity. 3 more members finally reached Nancy and O'Leary. After waiting as long as they could, the 5-person group took shelter in a barn, where they remained for 2 freezing nights. After that, they spent 5 days making their way to the town of Canet-Plage, and from there, they went back to Françoise de Sade's apartment in Toulouse. Another bitter defeat. And yet, the biggest defeat was still to come. On March 2, 1943, O'Leary met with a fellow resistance contact at a cafe in Toulouse. Within seconds, he was surrounded by Gestapo. The contact he was meeting with, a man named Roger, was actually a Nazi, known as Agent 47. Thankfully, Nancy had never met Roger, but the capture of O'Leary devastated her and the resistance. O'Leary would eventually be sent to Dachau concentration camp, where he remained for the rest of the war. Upon hearing of his capture, Nancy and Francois ditched Francois's apartment. Nancy teamed up with a French airman to attempt another escape. Weeks passed. Nancy acquired new clothes and new identification cards. The time had come. She had one last chance to get out of the country. At the beginning of May 1943, as the Allies were about to force the Axis out of North Africa, Nancy and the others left for Perpignan one final time. From there, they marched back to the foot of the Pyrenees and met their guides. For hours, they hiked and climbed up the treacherous, cold mountainside. With an elevation of over 11,000 feet, the mountains were known for their steep and jagged cliffs. At one point, they were forced to traverse the rockier side of the mountains to avoid Gestapo bloodhounds. For two full days, they climbed and marched with hardly any break. No one was allowed to make any sound or produce any smells that the hounds could track. That meant no smoking and no cooking. On the second day, a snowstorm hit them, and one of the travelers, an American, had a breakdown. He refused to continue. Nancy slapped some sense into him. After months of trying and failing to escape, leaving her husband behind, she was not going to let some weak American thwart her plan. Finally, they finished climbing up and started climbing down. They reached a farm where they could finally spend a warm night covered in hay. But while they slept, Spanish police arrived. They started ransacking the barn, stabbing the hay, looking for people. The Spanish police rounded them all up. During her interrogation, Nancy insisted that she was American and that if the Spanish didn't let her go, she would complain to the American ambassador. Afraid of drawing international ire, the Spanish put her in a hotel, and once there, she was able to contact the British consul. Nancy Wake was finally able to sail to London. On June 17, 1943, Nancy stepped foot on British soil in Greenock. After six agonizing months of failed escape attempts, she had reached safety. Not a single German in sight. Despite Henri not being with her, Nancy let out a sigh of relief, knowing that she didn't have to look over her shoulder anymore. Or so she thought. When Nancy finally got to London, where she'd lived for a time while attending journalism school, it wasn't the city she remembered. London had been battered with German bombs for 57 straight days. When she arrived, she stayed mostly in her hotel room. From time to time, she'd go out for a drink or two, but she wasn't the jubilant Nancy from yesteryear. She did, early in her arrival, reunite with her old friend, Ian Garrow, and word quickly spread among the men Nancy had rescued that she was in London. According to Nancy, at least 50 of them invited me to their homes, and I met their wives, or mothers, or fathers, or friends. The ones with money took me out to nightclubs, restaurants, and generally entertained me, which was very nice indeed. But it took time for Nancy to return to her old self. The scars of the war had shown themselves, and she needed to recover. Especially since she had no communication with her husband, Henri, who was still in Marseille. In the weeks and months that followed, it became clear to Nancy that Henri wasn't going to be joining her in Britain. This realization, oddly enough, brought Nancy back into the war. She knew it was dangerous for him to leave France. So if Henri wasn't going to come to her, then she would go back to him. she had a vow to keep, to damage Nazis and everything they stood for. She was in luck, because before long, a British intelligence officer came knocking at her door with a suggestion. If she wanted to keep fighting the Nazis, why not join Buckmaster's Group? Buckmaster's Group was the informal name given to the French section of the Special Operations Executive, or SOE, headed by Colonel Maurice James Buckmaster. The SOE was the brainchild of Winston Churchill following the evacuation of Dunkirk and the fall of France in 1940. Churchill wanted intelligence on German activities in France, and once he had it, he wanted to support the resistance through counter-information, espionage, and sabotage at all levels. The SOE welcomed Nancy. It appeared that they were very aware of her activities while working for the resistance and were pleased that she wanted to continue the fight. As talks continued, it became clear what her mission was going to be. The Allied invasion to liberate Europe was in preparation. Therefore, Nancy was going to be dropped behind enemy lines, meet with resistance groups scattered around the country, and integrate them into the invasion as saboteurs. It was exactly her kind of job. For the next 16 weeks, Nancy began her training as an SOE agent. The first session was done in a place known around the agency as the Madhouse. While there, Nancy went through rigorous physical and psychological training. Obstacle courses, rope climbs, all trials designed to push Nancy's physical and mental limits. During the psychological portions of her training, she gave her New Zealander psychiatrist more than he bargained for, especially when it came to the Rorschach test. Nancy is said to have described each card as simply ink blots, and when the psychiatrist angrily asked why she refused to cooperate, she asked him why he wasn't back in New Zealand fighting the Japanese. After the Madhouse, Nancy's training moved to Scotland. Here, the training focused on conducting acts of sabotage. She became an expert with explosives and firearms. She came to understand that blowing up a train wasn't just about blowing up a train, but about causing the most damage possible. She learned how to dismantle and reassemble the Bren Light machine gun and became an expert marksman with the Sten, a popular submachine gun among spies and resistance fighters for its lightweight and concealability. It was also in Scotland that Nancy learned how to silently kill with just her bare hands. The thought of actually doing it horrified her, but then again, given who the enemy was, she realized it was an important skill set to have, just in case. As the weeks ticked away, Nancy added radio building, surveillance, Morse code, and automobile sabotage to her bag of tricks. After Scotland, she moved to Manchester, where she learned how to parachute out of an airplane. Nancy quickly came to hate jumping out of planes and developed a fear of heights. From Manchester, her training moved to New Forest on the southern coast of England. Here, she learned everything about the German military. Tanks, aircraft, officer ranks, everything. In late March of 1944, after 16 grueling weeks, Nancy finished her SOE training. It was time for her mission. D-Day was fast approaching, and within a few short weeks, Nancy would find herself jumping into occupied France and preparing the resistance for the Allied invasion. Next week, we'll follow Nancy Wake as she returns to France to arm the French Marquis. We'll look at how they began a sabotaging reign of terror throughout France, resulting in a 5 million franc bounty on Nancy's head. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Carrie Murphy, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Liebeskind. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Espionage was written by Joe Guerra. I'm Carter Roy.